This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scher. Alexander Hamilton's papers run to 32 thick volumes. He wrote and wrote and wrote. Where a paragraph might do, Hamilton would produce a pamphlet. Ron Chernow, Hamilton's biographer, says he was the founder who mastered all the literary arts except brevity. Ron Chernow has written of other masters of the economy. His first book, The House of Morgan, won a National Book Award. He wrote the 1998 biography of John D. Rockefeller, Titan. His latest is Alexander Hamilton. Joins us in our studios. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure to be here, Steve.
I asked you this before we started, and I just wonder, do you come to like the people you are spending time with because you have to spend so much time with them, or do you choose them because even if they are considered flawed in some way, I mean, Morgan, Rockefeller, Hamilton, all have been controversial people. Do you think there's something
biography is
about
a very
it?
Intensifying experience, so that you go through extreme mood swings? It's a little bit like marriage. Neutrality is not an option. And yes, you can learn to love and even idealize the person you're writing about. If you're not careful, you can also swing to the other extreme and detest this person. You're trapped day after day. You end up spending more time with the biographical subject than you do with anyone else in your life. Luckily, with Hamilton, although I tried to present a warts and all portrait of him, it is, in the end, a sympathetic and admiring portrait.
Now, how did that happen, considering that Hamilton, down through the years, and as you write about, as we'll talk about, had many of his enemies had much more time to cast aspersions on his character than he could have responded to. So how did it happen that it becomes a sympathetic portrait, waltz and all? What about him is sympathetic?
Well, one of the things that I say in the book, I describe Hamilton as the messenger from the future. This was certainly, he was the most clairvoyant of the founders. He was clairvoyant certainly on the economic side in terms of foreseeing an America dominated by cities, banks, stock exchanges, trade, commerce, at a time when the Jeffersonian vision was of strong state governments, weak central government, and a nation of small yeoman farmers, and in fact, the reality being large slave plantations. And so that I think that we can do justice to Hamilton now because we are inhabiting the world that he envisioned, not the world that Jefferson envisioned. And Hamilton at the time was seen through a certain filter, and that filter was that banks and finance and commerce, that these things were by nature evil. And so anyone who was advocating those things had to be by definition evil.
That was the view in the populace of the U.S.?
Well, this was the view actually Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, John Adams, so far-seeing in political terms, when it came to economic terms, saw banks, for instance, as these diabolical contrivances, as they call them.
Were they evil because they were European?
I think that they were associated with European societies. Now, one of the things that I liked about Hamilton was that the other founders tended to have more of a sense that the world would learn from us, and I think that the world has learned a lot from us. Hamilton, I think, more than any other founder, also felt that we had a great deal to learn by studying the rest of the world. So he very closely studied the experience of the British, the Dutch, and the French in particular in terms of how they had achieved their political and economic preeminence. So that there were certain things that were considered it was really a case of guilt by association because England had a Bank of England, therefore central banks must be a bad thing.
Where did he? Where did you learn that about Hamilton, that he saw the need and wanted to learn from the rest of the world? Does that run through all his writings?
Oh, it's clear. I mean, for instance, when he created the first central bank, this was the forerunner of the Federal Reserve System. We'd had a first central bank, first bank of the United States, second bank of the United States, then a long stretch in the 19th century where we didn't have any central bank. But when he was sitting there writing the charter of the first bank of the United States, he actually had the bylaws of the Bank of England on his desk. We know that in certain cases he quoted it rather closely. And so in certain cases we can see very clearly his intellectual influences. His sister-in-law was in London. She was constantly shipping off different books to him that were popular on the continent.
Ron Chernow has written a biography of Alexander Hamilton. The rap against Hamilton. So I told somebody I was reading this book about Hamilton and said, this is a good book, you should read it. And they said, why do I want to read about him? He was the first Republican, in pejorative terms, that was stated. Would he be a Republican today?
Well, it's interesting. If I described to you a white man who was a Southern slaveholder who owned 200 blacks, who believed strongly in states' rights, who belonged strongly in strict construction of the Constitution, who was for cutting government spending and believed very strongly in cutting taxes, would I be describing Thomas Jefferson or Alexander Hamilton? I'd be describing Thomas Jefferson. But does that sound more like the forerunner of the Democratic Party, the forerunner of the Republican Party? You know, it's very, very difficult. They don't kind of match up evenly what we have today.
But he is the founder who's viewed negatively by many people today, whereas, of course, it is changing. But whereas Jefferson, Adams, Madison, Monroe are sort of seen as the founders that support the Democratic America.
You know, I should say, Hamilton was seen as not only Anglophile, as you pointed out before, but as this pseudo-aristocratic character, this terrible snob and elitist. One of the things that most interested me in doing the book was that Hamilton was as free of prejudice as any man I have ever studied. And this is after 5 years in his daily company. He was the most passionate abolitionist of all the founding fathers, bar none. During the American Revolution, he champions a plan to emancipate any slave who's willing to pick up a musket for the Continental Army. He then gets out of the war, starts his legal career in New York, and he co-founds the Manumission Society, the first abolitionist society in New York. For the next 20 years, off and on, works as a lawyer helping to defend free blacks or freed blacks who were kidnapped off the street of New York and tried to the masters tried to take them back into slavery. Here's someone he helps to start something called the Oneida, Hamilton Oneida Academy, later Hamilton College, to educate Native Americans. I found in his papers unpublished statements about Jews and how extraordinary the Jews were, and there must be some divine providence behind this. And so for somebody who was considered to have so little sympathy with ordinary people, he was somebody who had, in terms of, you know, racial and ethnic and religious issues, I think, as enlightened or more enlightened views than any other founder.
Jefferson, in his contradictions, sometimes says, well, someday the slaves will be free and we'll ship them back to Africa.
Right.
Did Hamilton see a northern meritocracy where all people could live and work and have businesses?
Well, that's right. Hamilton was an abolitionist who not only thought that the black slave trade should be stopped and then the slaves emancipated, but he never uttered one sentence about then relocating the slaves. With Jefferson, it was always, we'll ship them out west, we'll ship them to the Caribbean, we'll ship them back to Africa. You know, also James Madison, because these were both men on paper and principle who were opposed to slavery. But it was always combined with the belief that freed blacks could not coexist with whites. Jefferson, late in life, made a famous statement around the time of the Missouri Compromise. He said to slavery, it's like we have the wolf by the ear. We can't hold on to the wolf, but we can't let the wolf go because the wolf will devour us. So he felt that the blacks had been so humiliated by slavery, there would be a day in reckoning, and that they would never be able to forget the injustices that had been inflicted on them by the whites.
Looking into the life and times of Alexander Hamilton, one of the founders of the American government. Ron Chernow is his biographer. Ron Chernow has written a number of biographies about some of the titans of, I guess, American economy, the House of Morgan, John D. Rockefeller. He's self-educated, for the most part.
This is one of the great autodidacts of history, because he's illegitimate, he's orphaned, he's toiling away at this trading house in St. Croix.
Lucky to be working at that trading house, yes?
Felt very lucky, yeah. And in fact, is such a young prodigy that when the boss, who was from New York, went back to New York at one period, here Hamilton, who was 16 years old at the time, is running the whole trading house and ordering around the skippers. And it was a complicated operation. But we don't know of any formal education that he had before he came to North America around age 17 or 18. What happened? There was a massive hurricane on St. Croix, and Hamilton, who was already beginning to do poems and other pieces for the local paper, the Royal Danish American Gazette, suddenly publishes this description of the hurricane, which is considered of such precocious power that the local merchants realize they have this Wunderkind in their midst. They take up a subscription fund and they send him to North America to be educated. He trains for about 6 months at a prep school in Elizabeth, New Jersey, then for maybe a couple of years at King's College, later Columbia in Lower Manhattan. How he got work done, I don't know. He's writing polemical pamphlets against the British. He's drilling with a musket in the local churchyard. He's making these rabble-rousing speeches on the common where City Hall Park is today in New York. He was really undergraduate extraordinaire. But I think that the most – and then even during the American Revolution, I discovered he's toting around these very, very heavy volumes and taking extensive notes. He's giving himself – during the Revolution at night, he's giving himself a crash course in politics, history, finance. He was an absolute phenomenon.
How does Hamilton end up being in the military, and how does he end up in the end to be working with George Washington?
He was always fascinated by the military. In fact, the first letter we have from him at age 14 ends, "I hope there is a war." He always dreamed of military glory. When he's an undergraduate, he's appointed captain of an artillery company in New York. He's reading all of these books on gunnery and military matters. And various Revolutionary War generals, Nathaniel Greene, Henry Knox, and others see him drilling his company. His company is famous for Hamilton was a very, very sort of disciplined, hardworking person. People who then speak to him find him extraordinary. And he had this... I mean, it's partly his brilliance. It was partly a certain kind of orphan's psychology that he knew how to form these instant connections with powerful patrons. Again, this is someone who's living on his own wits. He has no parents, no birth or breeding, as they said in the 18th century. He has to make – and then finally at the Battle of White Plains, talking late 1776 now, Washington has a chance to observe him directly. And by the spring of 1777, he's Washington's aide-de-camping Hamilton and rather ambitious, ends up essentially as chief of staff.
What was their falling out, Hamilton and Washington? What happened?
Well, what happened for 4 years, Hamilton had been chained to his desk, and anybody else would have been thrilled by having this very prestigious job. But Hamilton was a kind of reckless daredevil. He yearned for battlefield glory, but Washington needed him for handling correspondence and other diplomatic duties. Also, Hamilton, this is a very different picture than the one we get of Washington ordinarily. Hamilton saw Washington every day behind the scenes, and he found Washington a very irritable, you know, quick-tempered, snappish kind of person. After 4 years, couldn't take it. You can't run the Continental Army in those circumstances and sort of just be a kind of soft shoe boss. One day, Hamilton passes Washington on the stairs, and Washington says he wants to see Hamilton. Hamilton goes down the stairs. He talks to Lafayette for a minute or two and comes back up the stairs, and Washington says, "You know, you have shown me disrespect, sir." And Hamilton says, "Then we must part, sir." And this was really something. I think this was a case of Hamilton seizing on a pretext for a falling out, because it was the only way he thought he could get into the battlefield. Washington, to his credit, and I think it's quite extraordinary, it's Washington an hour later who sends an aide to apologize. It was a very big thing of Washington.
So what happened with Hamilton? Did he get the chance?
Yeah. Finally, Washington gives him the command to lead an infantry battalion at Yorktown. And in fact, it's Hamilton, his great moment of heroism. He sprints across the battlefield with shells exploding in the sky above him. Comes to the outer rampart. He was only about 5'6 or so. He had one of his subordinates kneel down, hopped on the guy's shoulder, sprang up onto the parapet, exhorted the others to follow, and he became a military hero. And actually, then as now, that was an important part of a political career, the same way that so many of the major political figures in the early years of the Republic had been military heroes, most notably George Washington, or after the Civil War, you have, you know, all of these generals. Hamilton, I think, realized the political significance of being a battlefield hero rather than just winning the distinction of being the greatest aide-de-camp in history. Doesn't have quite the same ring.
Ron Chernow has written a biography of Alexander Hamilton, and I've been sort of dominating this conversation, so let me bring in. Here's R. Copeland's email. Hamilton, unless I'm mistaken, advocated limiting the right to vote to property owners with a certain minimum net worth. This seems rather elitist. Did he really believe that all men are created equal, or did he, like most of the founders, understand men to mean white men of certain economic status?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the thrust of the question is fair, but it wasn't limited to Hamilton, the idea that it was limited to people who had a certain amount of property. Hamilton was an elitist. I think that he felt that the people should be led by their most educated representatives. This is built into our Constitution. You know, we have a system where congressmen are elected every 2 years, president every 4, senators every 6, et cetera, as a way of providing some insulation between political deliberations and popular passions.
All right, one quick email could Alexander Hamilton have been a black man?
He may have been. I put a lot of investigation into this and concluded, again, any conclusion in history is provisional. I concluded that he wasn't and that there was a presumption that any illegitimate kid from the Caribbean must be a product of some mixed racial match. But it was said at the time. It still is said today. I actually explored different kinds of genetic tests on locks of his hair. I wasn't averse to the idea. It would actually be interesting to have a founder of mixed racial ancestry. But I can't say that I found any evidence of it.
Ron Chernow's book is Alexander Hamilton. This is Weekday on KUOW, Northwest Public Radio.